Just Love on the Catholic Channel,
Sirius XM 129.
The Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love with your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Executive Director of Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York.
Welcome back to Just Love. Thank you for being with us again this week. We always appreciate the fact when our listeners are with us. Because we tape the show, we can't invite you to kind of call in. We used to when it was live, but now that it's taped, we don't. But so you can have your questions in your head, and hopefully we kind of deal with them with our guest. And I think you should know that the shows are on the website of Catholic Charities and to Just Love. So if by some chance, and Tom, I doubt that our faithful listeners ever miss an episode, because they wouldn't want to miss the sterling guests that you gather every week for us and the scintillating conversations that we have. But if by some chance they can't listen to the show, they can go on the website and they can hear the podcast or whatever, whenever they want to listen to it. So I think, you know, Tom, I think we should, you know, periodically remind our listeners that it is available, that so they can go on the website to do that. Tom, it is the fall. We're at the Columbus Day weekend. You have any specific fall plans?
I love the autumn because the weather to me is finally comfortable enough. You could walk around, you know, during the summertime, I tend to feel the heat. So, you know, I'm always in the t-shirt and shorts, but now you can finally dress up and you can wear your jackets. And, you know, there's a thing on Saturday Night Live where they always call it sweater weather. So we're finally in sweater weather. So I'm actually very, very grateful for that, Monsieur. So you know me, I like to just walk around the city.
Yeah.
I like to enjoy. I always find the daylight at this time of year, because although it's getting darker earlier, I always find when the sun is kind of low on the horizon, the light is beautiful. So walk around the city is just beautiful this time of year.
So let me for our listeners throughout the country, Manhattan is a very interesting place for so many different reasons. But I think those who are not from New York, they kind of pay attention to the movies, or, you know, and even those who come here, they know about Broadway. They know about maybe the Statue of Liberty. They know about all of those things. And everybody probably knows about Times Square from New Year's Eve, et cetera. So there's a lot of those things which are kind of wonderful parts of New York. But what I think probably most people don't know is there's a varied part of New York, and they probably know this, but it has an implication that Manhattan is actually an island. So it's surrounded by water. Tom, you like to walk, but tell our listeners a little bit about the new thing they did. I think it's almost at the end of your block. On the East River.
Oh, yeah.
So tell them. Now, again, one of the things, again, a little bit of urban history for our listeners throughout the country. There were some decisions made by planners years ago, which created a little bit of a problem. They built highway that was kind of down the Hudson River, and the other side of Manhattan Island, they built it down the East River. And the way they put the highways that were there, it made it very, very difficult for ordinary people to access the beautiful East River and the beautiful Hudson River. They kind of made people impossible to do that. Probably in the past 30, 40, 50 years, you know, the people in New York said, wait a minute, they're so beautiful. What are we going to do about helping people to appreciate these tremendous bodies of water which surround this incredibly dense populated region with high skyscrapers, office building, residential buildings, et cetera, et cetera. So, Tom, that's my little lead-in to tell our listeners what they did at the end of your block.
Sure, Monsieur. Well, what they did, and they opened it up last year. I think it was last year they opened up. They installed this beautiful walkway. And it's got, as Monsieur had mentioned, it's got kind of a little overpass that goes over the East Side Drive. So you're able to actually access it from, you know, from the sidewalk. And it probably runs about 10 blocks up on the east side, but it's beautiful. It's got it's got a track for people who run. It's got a place where people can walk. It's got trees. It's got greenery. It's got places where you can sit and eat your lunch. And I love it. I mean, I just go down now during, you know, during the summertime, especially. I just go down and people will, you know, say they'll go to the beach or they'll go there. I go there. I would say I just go, and it's absolutely beautiful. You get yourself, you maybe some coffee, you get yourself a sandwich, you can just go sit down, you watch the boats go by, you're right on the river, so it's almost like being on a boat. It's really, it's spectacularly beautiful. It's one of the best things I think New York City has done, you know, park wise in the last 20 years, Monsieur. It's really,
so
it's really
beautiful. I agree with you, and I'll add a little bit to it. About, this is pre-COVID, I walked all around Manhattan Island, the perimeter of Manhattan Island, not in one day, four times. I broke it into four quadrants. But the area that you're talking about, Tom, was an area that was very disappointing because you had to get off of the drive, the park that was near the river, and you had to walk down the city streets for probably a mile or two before you could get back on. So you couldn't do it. So I know exactly what you're talking about, that area. So they've opened up more of it. But Tom, what I'm not sure of is, can you walk south or only north?
You can only, it's north, Monsignor. Because I think, I believe that it kind of cuts off right where the United Nations is. Yep. And I'd imagine for security reasons, they're probably not going to let you walk down by the UN, but maybe they will. I mean, I guess we have to wait.
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure about that. But I think, you know, because the area, and I can say to our listeners, I'm sorry if this doesn't mean much to you, but from the area where Tom gets on, it's another 10 blocks south, or about a half a mile before you can walk along the river again, because you can begin walking down from around 34th Street, somewhere around there. But you got to get off there. So anyway, but thank you for sharing that. And it's a wonderful time. Let's go to our first guest, Professor William Connell, who is a professor of history, the LaMotta Endowed Chair in Italian Study at Seton Hall University. I am delighted, and I want to thank Professor Connell for joining us on Just Love today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Monsignor. Thanks for the invitation. I'm delighted to be here on Just Love with you.
So would you give our listeners a little bit of your little bit of your CV? But Professor Connell, I don't want the 27-page academic one with every single thought you had and every essay you ever wrote. Just give our listeners the abbreviated version, so they at least have a little sense of the voice behind that they're hearing on the radio.
Sure. I guess professionally, I am a historian who specializes in Italian and Italian American history.
Okay.
Let's see. My involvement with Italy goes back to playing stickball on the streets of Yonkers with the Italian-American boys who had grandmothers who would come out at 3 p.m.
Near Nodine Hill?
No. It was so long ago, but it was near Cross Street and by Central Avenue. The Cross County Library.
I grew up in Yonkers.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I know where you're talking. Cross County Center and then Tuckahoe Road and up in that area.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. But we only lived there for 3 years. And I was a little boy. But these grandmothers, the nonne, spoke no English.
Okay.
And they would give the little Irish boy an extra
right.
cookie if I said a word in Italian.
Ah.
And their parents were not encouraging them to speak Italian. So
Right.
I quickly became the Beniamino, the little favorite boy in the neighborhood. So that's where I learned my first words of Italian.
Oh, that's wonderful. That is wonderful.
And
Great.
Let's see what else. I've
So, you
published
know,
lots
okay.
of,
So,
yeah.
Professor Connell, maybe our listeners don't care, but the area where you grew up in, there were a lot of Italian laborers
Yes.
who worked in that part of Yonkers there, Tuckahoe, all of that area. Because Yonkers in that part had a lot of Italian Americans and had a lot of Irish Americans in that part of the world when you were growing up there. So I'm not surprised that you kind of ran into the Italian grandmothers.
Right. And we lived in that area for a
Right.
long time after we moved out of Yonkers,
Right.
and we were adopted at one point by two families in Eastchester and Tuckahoe. Invite us to Easter, Christmas,
Right.
Thanksgiving, and so forth. So a very
So
important part of my life.
so I have to ask you the question. The red liquid that went on pasta, sauce or gravy?
Sauce for
Okay.
us, for our
Okay.
families, you know,
Okay.
but I've heard disputes and debates about that for a long
Oh,
time.
those can be heated arguments because my godmother is Italian.
Yeah.
So on
Okay.
Sunday, there was always the gravy or the sauce argument as to what the red stuff should be called.
True. And the important thing was to have the argument.
That's right. And because if you didn't have the argument, it meant you weren't friends.
So I don't know. So that's that part of it. But I've spent many years in Italy, and I've studied both the Middle Ages and Renaissance period of Columbus. I've written a lot about him and about Machiavelli and other
Right.
people in the 15th and
Right.
16th centuries. But then also I've edited the really it's the this the standard and authoritative history of Italian Americans. And
Ah.
I've worked closely with the Italian American community, especially in New Jersey. I'm a professor at Seton Hall University,
Right.
and I hold a chair in Italian studies that was generously funded by the Italian community at that university. So.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much. That gives us a little bit of background. And I'm glad a kid from Yonkers made it good. So
thank
thank you for that. So we'll get into kind of the Indigenous Day story a little bit later. But how did Columbus, who was financed by the Spanish monarchy, how did he become the great Italian American hero? How did that become such a big thing?
It's a long story. In the United States,
Right.
it begins with 1792 was the first celebration of Columbus Day, and he was celebrated as the person who made possible the creation of a completely new kind of country, a
Right.
democracy. With its own constitution established on enlightened principles, like all men are created equal, with rights
Right.
of freedom of speech and freedom of religion. And he made that possible because it was understood you couldn't do that in old Europe. Too many well-rooted interests in old Europe. And through the 1800s, Columbus was seen in that light as really the first of the many founders of our country, because he made that possible, even though he was understood as largely a Spanish figure. They knew that he was from Italy, but Spain was a huge preoccupation in the 1800s as the Latin American countries gained their independence. Spain, ultimately, we'd fight a war with Spain in 1898. So there's the biography by Washington Irving is based on sources that he developed. he became ambassador to Spain. So there's this, so Columbus is seen as a Spanish figure, not an Italian figure. And it's only with the mass immigration of the 1880s that Italians will realize that, well, you know, we have a hero of our own background, who's already considered one of the founders of the United States. And at that point, the Italians were sort of at the bottom rung of the ladder of immigrant right. nations and nationalities. And so he was seen as a figure that could offer them a kind of legitimation. And so they began playing a prominent place in parades. They raised money for the Columbus Monument in New York City at Columbus Circle. So there's this kind of growing, spreading appreciation of Columbus and promotion of Columbus by Italian Americans that will then continue through the 20th century.
We're speaking with Professor William Connell, Professor of History and the La Mater Chair in Italian Studies at Seton Hall University. And it's Columbus Day weekend, so we are speaking about the legacy of Columbus. A little bit, it seems to me, a little bit ironic when you mentioned that his celebration as kind of opening up for a new type of democracy that was not available in Europe at that time. And correct me if I'm wrong, okay, because I'm not a scholar, but he didn't have the slightest intent to do that. He was doing this as like exploration for trade and things like that.
Oh,
am
sure.
I correct on that?
Absolutely. No, it was, but if you think about it, the settlers, the coloners, mm-hmm. when they're thinking land first,
right.
And Columbus is thinking land first, so that it made it possible. Mm-hmm. You know, if I Neil Armstrong didn't know what kind of government yes. there would be on the moon, but if we have to leave the planet Earth and colonize it,
right,
they would still be celebrating Neil Armstrong.
Right. Which leads me to kind of the next part of our conversation. Can you speak to us about how now and when did it begin? There was a recognition that what Columbus did in maybe opening the continent to the development of democracy, that there was also an incredibly negative part of that, particularly on the people who were already here, the indigenous people who were here. How did that awareness kind of surface? Can you give us a little bit of that history?
Sure. Actually, the awareness comes not directly. I see the awareness arriving in the general. In general terms in American culture in the late 1960s, early 1970s, when there's a book called Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. And that's when the general media, the America of the suburbs, the America of immigrants, all become aware of the terrible tragedies that occurred among Native peoples in the Americas. It's interesting how Columbus figures in the United States later in the story of that recognition. It's not really until 1992. So if you study the anti-Columbus activism and the pro-Native American activism, the pro-Native American activism begins earlier. It's 68, 70, the occupation of Alcatraz, for instance, by the American Indian movement, and the establishment in 1970 of what was called a National Day of Mourning at Plymouth Rock. And so the first, on Thanksgiving Day, so the first push as a kind of strategic thing was against Thanksgiving, which I have to say, although it did some wonderful things for the Wampanoag peoples in Massachusetts, didn't have much resonance in the United States. Thanksgiving, people are watching football, they're at home, and they still do a national day out at Plymouth Rock. But the weather's colder, and there was almost a strategic choice in 1992 when historians of demography were showing that there was a tremendous mortality because of the exchange of diseases throughout the Americas. People dying long before any Europeans had even arrived in their parts of the Americas. So that historical.
Professor Connell, and again, I'm a little in, I'm very intrigued by it. Say a little bit more about the 1970 day that began at Plymouth and Thanksgiving. Say a little bit more about that. That intrigues me.
I remember reading I don't even think I think I was a teenager yet, but I remember seeing the picture in the New York Times of people in blankets, and it was cold out on the Massachusetts shore. And it's been a movement to try to gain recognition for Native Americans and in the same way that the civil rights, it was one of the different movements of minority groups trying to gain recognition on in the wake of the civil rights movement of the late 50s, early 60s.
That is, again, it's interesting, and I'll just, Tom knows this, but I'll just tell you a little family story as you talk about. It didn't get much attention because families were gathering for Thanksgiving, watching football, whatever. But very, very interesting. One of the customs that my family has developed is at 6 o'clock in the evening, we listen to the Arlo Guthrie song, Alice's Restaurant.
Wonderful.
And that focuses what's going on in almost the same part of the world that this day, what day of remembrance or day of,
I think of morning, but
okay, day of mourning. But so what you said resonated a whole lot with me.
Right. And so now 1992 comes around. There's solid books by historians about what had happened. I did my doctoral degree at Berkeley, University of California. And it was actually in Berkeley that you have the very first celebration of Indigenous Peoples Day in 1992. And the people who organized it had gone to a conference in Ecuador the year before, where among Latin American leftist activist groups, it was laid out this strategy of activating and they considered it successful. It had been tried by Castro and Che Guevara, and it was about to take off in Venezuela, which happens to be in Caracas, is the very first place that a Columbus statue was pulled off of its pedestal, was in Caracas, Venezuela. But these Berkeley activists had been to Latin America and saw that you could, in Latin America, activate indigenous peoples where you have much larger populations to take power back from people descended largely of European ancestry in Venezuela, in Bolivia, in Peru. So we have this kind of radical agenda in Berkeley, and Berkeley didn't have many Italian Americans, and so it spread as a kind of progressive movement, this taking on Columbus Day. Now, one of the advantages from a strategic point of view, I'm trying to think from the point of view of the progressives. I actually have no problem with Columbus Day. I think it's a great holiday. But the strategic point of view, there's something about Italian Americans that if you have a protest against people who descended from the Mayflower, who are on their televisions, they're not going to get angry. They're just going to shrug their shoulders. Italian Americans instead get all angry. And that creates exactly the kind of publicity that can help you. because it gets media attention. And so there's this kind of backfiring or feeding off back. And it's, sometimes you wonder if you want that they each need each other, Italian American activists and Native American activists. If you go instead to the reservations, you'll find that there's a great appreciation, among other things, for the Knights of Columbus, who donate generously to Sioux reservations and other Native American causes. So, but that's
so. Where would you say we are today? I mean, this is a broad question. As a nation, okay, we kind of, the movement begins in Berkeley around in the 1990-ish. But where are we today? It seems to me, if you asked me, I didn't know it began in Berkeley in 1990. I would say, to me, I think this movement is like 15 years old. That's, you know, when I'm, but I'm not saying I'm right. All I'm saying, you know, it didn't seem to me to make it a little bit more mainstream to a little bit later than that. Is my memory correct?
No, I things like the Disney Pocahontas movie really sort of changed, especially in primary education. You know, I remember the little skits of Columbus and Queen Isabella on the stage, and then combining with and feeding right into then the later Thanksgiving skits that they would teach in schools. There were standard scripts for them and everything.
Right.
But that all sort of started going out, I think you're right, about 15 years ago. So what was a small fringe thing and a real sort of festive occasion, I was there for an early Berkeley. It was a lot of fun marching through the streets, people dancing and dressed wonderfully, celebrating indigenous peoples. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's true, you know? And it was positive too, rather than being a negative a kind of celebration.
Am I correct? And this is, let me put something out there, and you please react, correct me, provide your own perspective on this. It seems to me, at least in the United States and probably worldwide, but in the United States, we've become much more divided than we had been 50 years ago. And it almost seems like, and I'm going to exaggerate this a little bit, is that not only do I want to win, but you have to lose. And so, like, if we want to celebrate indigenous people, then we have to not celebrate Columbus. And it's like, that just seems to me the atmosphere that I've picked up in the past 5 years. But you have a better feel for this.
Well, I would agree with you, Monsignor. And as a historian, I think it helps to step back and realize that that October 12th, 1492, is the most important date that we can securely date in human history. You know, it might be, unfortunately, the first atom bomb explosion, but I can't say that that has changed the world in the same way. And so Christians would say that it was the birth of Christ, but they couldn't agree whether he was born whether the important day was the Annunciation, March 25th, or whether it was December 25th. And then there's December 25th it doesn't fit within the years. And King Herod died in 4 BC. So we don't know exactly as historians the date of the birth of Christ. October 12th, 1492, name me a date. It's not the man on the moon. No. Fortunately, we can say that I think that's the, and so if we take that, that's the day that made the world we know more than any other single day that you can.
That's interesting.
Specifically. Yeah.
Right.
And I have no problem with that being remembered, commemorated. It should be on the federal calendar. And and both sides, if you're celebrating Columbus or if you're as a man, or if you're celebrating Native American culture and remembering it, you're still referring to that same day. And so in a way, why not just bring people back together again instead of fighting turf wars over who owns that day, you know? In 1992, there was awareness of things changing, and I think it was the governor of Illinois, a good friend of mine, a historian at Queens College, Fred Gardefee, told me about how the governor of Illinois said that for Chicago's Columbus Day parade, they invited Native Americans from reservations in Illinois to march too, and they were burning sage, which is a traditional Native American way of remembering the past and the dead, and I think that's a that offers a good model, I would say.
Well, Professor William Connell, thank you so much for this. I mean, I learned a whole lot, and I think your perspective is we can celebrate a lot. We don't have to only celebrate one thing. And we also, I think, can recognize that the impact of certain things that were positive did have some very negative impacts at the same time. We don't have to sweep those under the rug, but I
Sure.
think understanding we can recognize multifacets of history, I'm a little sad that I think we've kind of lost the widespread interest in doing that. Let me just say it that way, that we don't like to be that nuanced or that rich in our understanding of things.
Well, there needs to be a more embracing of each other
I
in
think that's,
our country.
well,
Absolutely.
Professor Connell, I think that's a great way to end. The professor of history, the LaMotta Endowed Chair in Italian Studies, and maybe someday he will figure out whether it is gravy or whether it is sauce. Thank you for being with
Well
us.
said. Thanks so
Just
much.
love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. We'll be back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Now let's get back to Just Love and your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love, our weekly conversation about what's going on in the world through the prism of our Catholic social teaching. Thanks so much for being with us this week. Columbus Day weekend. I am really delighted that Professor Connell was able to kind of provide a little bit of historic information and perspective on Columbus Day and also the rise of the celebration of Indigenous peoples on the same day. And I thought a very kind of good and balanced view of that. So I'm delighted that he was able to join us today. I am also very, very pleased that we are able to have with us Catholic Charities USA 2025 Volunteer of the Year. And each year, Catholic Charities raises up somebody who has done a great deal of volunteer work, supporting the needs of their agency people in their communities. And I'm delighted that this year we have with us Deacon David Hessling, who is from Catholic Charities of Western Tennessee, that he has graciously agreed to give us a few moments of his time on Just Love. Deacon David Hessling, thank you so much for joining us on Just Love.
Good morning, Monsignor, and thank you for the invitation. I'm honored, I'm privileged, I'm humbled. Thank you.
Well, the one thing I just want to assure you, neither in terms of the size of our audience nor in the style of the show is this 60 minutes. Okay? So we're not doing investigative journalism, whatever. We just want to hear of the wonderful generosity that you've been as a volunteer and a little bit about your volunteer work. I'm going to ask you a little bit about you being a deacon. And basically, this is to give you the opportunity to, as the gospel would say, put your lamp a little bit on a lampstand so that others might be inspired. And maybe some of the generosity in our listeners might come out and they might be able to get a little bit more involved in their community. So I, again, thank you so much for being with us. So maybe why don't we begin? Give us a little bit of your background. How'd you wind up kind of being a deacon? How'd you wind up volunteering?
Well, Monsignor, I guess that when I retired from civil service 7 years ago, I kind of was aimlessly wandering, as many retirees do, and thought I was doing all the right things with regards to the church. You know, I was in the choir, and I'm a lector, and extraordinary minister, and you know, Knights of Columbus, doing all the things that I thought were the right things to do.
Before we get there, Deacon, what'd you do for your day job before you retired?
I was an information systems manager.
Okay.
Yeah, I ran computer systems for the Navy.
Oh, okay. You made sure that the things went in the right directions and the data got in the right holes and people knew what they were doing.
Correct. Try to make jobs easier for them.
Well, I like that. So that is a good ministry. Let me tell you, that is that is good, because you know from our Catholic social teaching, work and the dignity of work is an important value for us. So if you made that job easier, you were making a major contribution. So thanks for doing that all those years.
It was my pleasure.
Great.
So so about 6.5 years ago, I guess, my pastor at the time asked me a question, and that just really has changed my life. He asked me if I'd ever considered a call to the diaconate. And because my parish is a pretty small parish, only about 100 and some families, we've never had a deacon. And so I really never had access to a deacon other than some friends of mine that were. I said, well, no, but let me think about this. And so for about a year, my wife and I discerned and prayed and did a lot of paperwork and a lot of interviews and things of this nature. And so we began the journey. And over the course of our 5 years of formation, you know the four dimensions, the human, the spiritual, the intellectual, the pastoral. I don't know. They all kind of pulse into one big basket. My intention was, I'm going to do this and we'll see where it goes. And if I didn't make it to ordination, I was thinking, well, think of all the good things I'm going to learn about my church.
Wonderful.
And it turned out.
Give our listeners just a little bit of sense. In which part, which neck of the world were you hanging out?
So we live in Tipton County, Tennessee, which is on the west side of Tennessee, borders the Mississippi River. And to the south of us is Shelby County, that has Memphis. Okay.
So I'm a typical New Yorker. Okay. Are you near Nashville or Fort Knox?
We are west of Nashville.
Okay.
At the end of the state of Tennessee. If you hit the Mississippi River, you've gone too far.
Okay, great. Okay, so we now for us who are a little bit geographically challenged, I got a sense.
Okay, so my parish is St. Alphonsus Catholic Church in Covington, Tennessee, and like I said, we got about a hundred or so families. Nice little country church. A lot of older folks and several military families that were stationed in Millington at the Naval Base. So it's a very nice little parish. We've been there for 25 years now, and we really, really enjoy the family environment that St. Alphonsus offers us. So we made it through formation, and I don't know, by the grace of God, you know, the bishop said, yeah, okay, I guess I'll ordain you.
hey, and so, Deacon, that's exactly what happened to me like almost 50 years ago, where the Archbishop of New York said, he's not so bad. We'll take him. So yeah, it's kind of a similar thing.
Right. So September 20th, just a few weeks ago, I was made a deacon, and it was a beautiful, beautiful liturgy. And I'm really, truly looking forward to years of service for my parish family and to our bishop and our diocese.
Great. So we're speaking with Deacon David Hessling, who is Catholic Charities USA 2025 Volunteer of the Year. So now, if you would, Deacon, tell us a little bit about your volunteering in Catholic Charities.
Well, Monsignor, so when I retired, I was looking for things to do. And we had at the time a small food pantry operation that at our parish. We've had that for, oh, I don't know, a dozen or more years. And I said, well, I'll see if I can get involved with that. And then, of course, we all know what happened, that nasty thing called COVID. Yeah. And pretty well shut everything down, including our food pantry operation. And so down the road, as things were starting to open up again, I saw a news article about a grant that had been given to the Mid-South Food Bank to buy food for families. And that Mid-South Food Bank is one of the organization that provides food to many agencies and organizations in Shelby County in West Tennessee, actually.
Right.
So I don't even remember what caused me to make the phone call, but I made a phone call to the then director, Kelly Henderson, of Catholic Charities West Tennessee, and asked him, is there any way that we can get access to some of this food for our community, for Tipton County? Within 15 minutes, he had me talking to the person who was in charge of that outreach. And within a short time thereafter, we had made arrangements for food boxes to be delivered to Covington so that we could begin this ministry. And we've been steadily growing the ministry. We have the food pantry operation that we do. We have thus far served almost 400,000 pounds of food since 2020.
Wow.
Last year alone was over 100,000. And 131,000 people have been served by this food pantry out of.
So Deacon, I'm going to interrupt you because I think all Catholic Charities throughout the country, a lot of our agencies do food in a lot of different ways. And I'm going to tap into your kind of Navy background as information systems, because I think almost all of us can't figure out how we count. So in other words, how many meals do you get out of a pound? How much does a pound cost? If you're measuring people, are you measuring them once a month, or are you counting them if they come every thing? So tell me a little bit about, I want you to help me, tell me about how you do the information system for your food pantry.
Well, one of the advantages to having an information systems background is I'm not afraid of things like spreadsheets and formulas and calculations.
Right.
And we have basically been able to maintain accurate statistics of all the services that we provided from day one. And in fact, Catholic Charities of West Tennessee is very happy with the product that we provide, because there's really no question as to who's getting the food and how much they're getting. And so we do a really, really good job of maintaining the administrative side. In fact, that's primarily my job, is to do that. I don't carry too many boxes to cars. I don't, I do help with registrations and things of this nature, but I do a lot of the administrative and the calculations. Yeah. And that. So we're pretty certain about the numbers.
Yeah. So, now, Deacon, we're going to have to invite you up to New York, because we could use a little bit of help in making sure that our numbers are on target.
Well, I haven't been to New York in a good while, so.
Come, you're welcome. You have a standing invitation. Come on, I'm up. Anyway, so I know you don't, like you said, you don't carry too many boxes, but you do register some people. Any particular individual or family that kind of sticks out with you for whatever reason when they came up and they said they needed some food? Anything sticks in your mind?
You know, Monsignor, there have been so many families. I think we've registered in total around 12,000 families, something like just 10 or 11,000 families over the course of 5 years. Many of those have become regular parts of our family, and some of them we see once or twice, we never see again. So there have been so many situations where it's, people have told us, if we weren't here, they don't know what we'd do.
So
When
I
I have
guess,
a
Deacon, what I'm pushing you on is because our listeners, they hear numbers, 12,000 or, but people tend to resonate with, an individual family. So all I'm asking is if there's one or two that stick out of those, that something about them, that their story, reminds us a little bit about the Jesus that is in them.
Well, the family that comes to us with five children, and the husband and wife have both lost their jobs just in the last week, and they don't know where to turn. They don't have any food in the refrigerator. They have nothing to give their kids. So just being able to help people in that regard, if you have a an elderly family member who comes in and she's trying to decide whether she should buy food or pay for her medicine. And we try to tell them and said, please, take care of your medicine. Take care of that. Come to see us. We'll give you food. We'll find food for you. We'll get it for you somewhere, but take care of yourself and we'll help. So those are the kind of things that stick out in my mind. We have a number of Tiny Blessings families. That's a second ministry that we have that runs in the afternoons. Which provides diapers and wipes and, for new mothers, car seats, swaddles, bottles, things that they can't afford to buy themselves because they're already asking us for food. So those are the stories that kind of stick in my mind, and there's so many of them, Monsignor. Just the need is so great.
So I got to ask you, I got to ask you an information systems question. When you analyze the data that you get, is there anything that you've discovered over these past few years that maybe was a little surprising about the people coming to the food pantry? When you kind of looked at all your spreadsheets, you said, any particular thing that maybe our listeners might not expect about people coming to a food pantry?
Well, probably about 38% of our families are elderly, and they live on a very small, typically a small Social Security check. And I unfortunately, there are many retirees that are not living very well because they just don't have the money. When we look at the large families that we serve, it's a probably about 17% of our number are large families. And many of them are so proud that they really don't want to come. But we tell them, I said, we can help you. And so that's what we try to do. We try to, we try to help each one of our families that come in. And we don't call
Let
them
me,
clients. They're not
yeah.
clients. They are
What do you call them?
families.
Yeah, family.
Families. They are our
Yeah.
families.
In the parish that I'm in the parish that I'm in New York, we're privileged to partner with the San Egidio community, and we're just so happy that they use our facility to do their Tuesday afternoon evening meal and outreach to the street. And they don't call them homeless, they call them their friends. And
Yes.
I think that's, some of it may be a little bit euphemistic, but I think it's important because from our Catholic perspective, these are individuals made in God's image and likeness, and anything we can do to raise up their humanity, and even if it's a little bit of euphemistic terms, I think that is good. Let me ask you one, and I'm going to go a little bit something that we've been discovering a lot recently, and you mentioned that couple who had lost their job. We're finding in New York that there are more and more people coming to our food programs who are actually working.
That is a real issue, Monsignor, and I've been struggling with that issue for a good while. We're an operation that works with volunteers. All my folks are all volunteers, and they all give their time up, on Tuesdays to come up and do this. But one of the concerns that I've had for a long time are the working poor. We've had some families come up and try to get food, and we've helped them out. But then they said, well, I don't know if I can come next week because I might have to work. know, and so we have this predicament, I guess you would say, that, you know, there are probably an equal number of families that could use our assistance, because they're working poor, but they have to work, and they can't come up to our ministry. One of the ways that we try to help with that is if they do get registered and they have a trusted person that they know could come up and pick up their food, we do allow them to pick up their food for them. Okay. But yeah, I think there's a real issue with the working poor. And now I will say that there are some other churches in Tipton County that have Saturday food pantries. Right. And so they have they're much larger congregations. And so they have a bigger opportunity to serve the working poor.
Deacon David Hessling, thank you so much for what you're doing. And thanks for sharing it with our listeners. And congratulations, being Catholic Charities USA 2025 Volunteer of the Year. Thanks for being with us on Just Love. Tom, I think it's time for us to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Just do it. Just love. Just check out Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, who's here right now. Take it away, Monsignor.
Hey, Tom, thank you so much for gathering our guests this week. I hope it was enlightening to listeners and a little bit of entertaining in the sense of keeping people track. The topics we talked about were very serious topics: hunger, people who don't have enough to eat, and the legacy of Columbus, indigenous people, very serious topics. But hopefully they enabled us to deepen our understanding of them, again, through our perspective of our Catholic values. So thank you for being with us on Just Love. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel,
Sirius XM 129.